from her bartending job in Poland. She shifts around the world every day because she's trying to build a Polish headspace. She was super tired and ready to sleep, though, so we didn't talk very much. Orla was happy, though, her tail wagging.
"Are we going to nap together?"
she asked her druid.
"I could go for a tandem napping session right about now."
"It's a deal,"
Grognewail said. "Both of our druids understand that napping is a team sport." Starbuck wanted to go with us to the lake, however, so the three of us shifted there to an old lodgepole pine Atticus had bound a long time ago. The squirrels in the neighborhood were properly respectful of us and ran away without argument or throwing their nuts around, unlike those city squirrels. The lake itself was very pretty, resting in a little valley beneath Strawberry Mountain, which did not look like a strawberry at all. We had it all to ourselves. It was still pretty cold outside, and few hikers were willing to brave such weather. Shuyuk had no problem with it, though. She walked up some time later after Starbuck and I had explored the whole perimeter of the lake. We were waiting for her on the side where Atticus said she'd be coming from, in the direction of the trailhead. She waved at us and was smiling until she got a good look at Atticus.
"What's wrong?"
"You knew who Hudson Keene was the whole time. You lied to me."
Her shoulders slumped, and her mouth twisted in remorse.
"Yeah, I did. I'm sorry. I was scared."
"You knew Ignacio Medina, too?"
"Yeah, I did. I was the one funding their research."
"You were the source of all those cash deposits?"
She nodded, her mouth a tight line of regret.
"I never really wanted to do what Dad was doing. Managing accounts for people like you. When he went roaming as a bear, it was me who looked after things, you know."
"Yeah, I knew that."
"Well, that meant we could never go roaming together, you know? When I was young, I mean the 17th century, back before the Russian fur traders came and wrecked our culture, we used to go to the salmon runs together every year and have the best time eating fresh fish out of the Karluk River or wherever else we went. But as the decades ticked past, he wound up having so many clients that it became a full-time job to just keep up with things. One or the other of us always had to be human. So a couple years back, I suggested this project to him as a way to keep ourselves flush but get out of the long-term accounting business. Riding high on an energy innovation would keep us rolling in money forever without having to do much day-to-day. Dad agreed, and we hooked up with Iggy and Hudson. When he got killed, well, I just kept going with it. I've let all the accounting clients go. This was my shot. But I don't have their research notes, so now it's toast."
"Maybe not,"
Atticus said.
"Tell me why Iggy was going to Eugene. You both went to see him off, right?"
"Yeah. He was heading down to check on a prototype installation we had set up. Inspect for degradation, record energy output and efficiency, that sort of thing."
"After Hudson got killed, didn't you call to warn him?"
Shuyuk nodded.
I did. As soon as I was out of the train station."
She dashed a tear away from the corner of her eye and sniffed.
"But it didn't do any good. They were waiting for him at the other end. He was supposed to call me back when he was safe, but he never did. When I called again to check up on him, I got a message that his number was out of service. They destroyed his phone."
"Who did this? Who are they?"
"Someone who either wants to prevent their tech from getting to market, or someone who wants to steal it. Take your pick."
"How'd you find out?
Did the police discover the lab?"
"No, not as far as I know, anyway. They showed me security footage from the train station. They have a clear shot of your face and saw you enter that stairwell with Hudson. They want to talk to you."
I really don't want to do that. They're going to dig around in my business and find out I'm 400 years old.
400? Wow.
Never mind that. They're gonna freeze my assets and take my DNA and figure out I'm not entirely human? I can't let them do that.
Why not? You haven't committed any murders they can pin on you, right?
Shuluk just stared at Atticus and said nothing, but she didn't have to. It wasn't hard to guess that those bodies back in the forest weren't the first that Shuluk had put down, and they wouldn't be the last.
Okay then, no DNA.
My druid said, and walked over to the shore. He picked up a flat rock and skipped it across the surface of the water 6 times, showing off his opposable thumbs. Shuluk joined him and skipped her rock 7 times.
Speaking of DNA, Hudson was my great-great-grandson.
No kidding.
No wonder he looked like you. Did you know?
No, I hadn't a clue.
I'd go mad if I tried to have a relationship with my descendants.
I understand. I have a few different lines of descent myself. You get lonely and it hurts too much, so you let yourself love for a while. But it's like getting drunk. Feels real good for a time, but the hangover's waiting on the other side. Kids, I mean.
Except they don't go away if you take 2 aspirin.
Couldn't tell you what happened to most of them. I only keep in touch with the one who got to be a bear. He's up in British Columbia, trying to start his own family right now.
That's great.
Sure is.
Shuluk picked up another rock and tossed it at the lake. But she must have lost her Zen mojo or something, because it just plunked in without skipping at all.
What did you mean when you said, maybe my plan isn't toast after all?
Hudson had his research, stored on an encrypted flash drive. I found it in his place and decrypted it, snuck it out of there right under the cops' noses.
I expected some jumping up and down at that point, or maybe a fist pump on Shuluk's part. But she stood very still, didn't even turn her head. She looked out at the lake and the silence grew. I lay down in the grass between them, and Starbuck crawled on top of me and sprawled across my back, sighing a spluttery sort of sigh.
What do you want?
Shuluk finally said.
I want you to tell me why you didn't have a copy of this already. And then I want in.
Shuluk grunted.
We had an informal agreement. They needed my money, and I needed their brains. They wanted to keep their research secret because most scientists get ripped off these days by the corporations that employ them. I said I'd agree to that if they followed a strict security discipline regarding their money and in going to the lab, so no one would realize what we were up to. The research was going well, and we were just about ready to file for incorporation and a patent, take everything from informal to formal. That office space above the train station was going to be our front. We were going to split the patent up 4 ways.
4 ways?
Dad was going to be the 4th.
Oh. Well, it can all still happen. Make me the 4th. Make Hudson and Iggy's families the other beneficiaries. Or not. Your call. In the meantime, I can make the police go away.
Shuluk's head moved ever so slightly in his direction.
How?
Let me record a video of your testimony, like an affidavit, and give me someone to go after.
I don't know who's doing this. I don't even know how anyone found out about the project. Either Iggy or Hudson screwed up somehow and let it leak.
We have to prove someone else committed the murders, or you can never live in the open again. You'll always be a suspect because of the security footage.
I know.
But I honestly haven't the slightest clue who's after us.
Atticus sighed.
We'll have to hope Detective Ibarra can come up with something then.
Chapter 8. Murder. By delivery.
I have to admit that humans are pretty funny when they get self-conscious. Point a camera at them and they instantly start worrying about how they look. They make a fuss about their hair, usually. But their greatest fear is that there might be a tiny little booger hanging out in their nostrils. Siluk Black was no different, even though she was a great big bear and could tear apart anyone who made fun of her boogers. Once Atticus pointed a camera at her, she became a wreck until Atticus reminded her that she was 400 years old and she should have oodles of dignity and gravitas, things that I didn't realize came in oodles until he said it. Atticus had shifted into town to get the camera with the memory card in it and came back to film Suluk in front of Strawberry Lake. She wouldn't give her name, or even any of her actual aliases, but made up a new one instead. She was the Marmot, a secretive financier of scientific research, who paid scientists in cash and operated in the shadows to foil the efforts of corporate espionage. She admitted to financing the solar research of Hudson Keene and Ignacio Medina, and recounted what happened in the stairwell, but refused to come into the police for questioning. She ended by stating her fervent hope that the police would catch the killers of two brilliant young minds.
"That's great,"
Atticus said as he turned off the camera.
"They won't give up on you with this, but at least they'll entertain other possibilities. They'll waste time searching for the Marmot, though, and that cracks me up."
Suluk had a cave up in the Strawberry Mountain wilderness somewhere, and she was going to be a bear for a while, but checked back at the lake every day to see if Atticus was there and needed to talk. They agreed to work on the solar business after the murders were cleared up, or at least Hudson's. We were pretty sure the murderers of Ignacio Medina had been buried outside Eugene, but Suluk wasn't a suspect in that one. Unless... "Hey, Atticus, after we leave, I have to run an idea by you to make sure we aren't chasing our tails here."
"Okay, buddy."
We said farewell to Siluk and shifted back to the cabin.
"What's the big idea?"
he said aloud. "Just making sure. What if Siluk was the one who paid the mercenaries to kill Hudson and Iggy so she could have the solar tech all for herself? She would have a financial motive, and by having Hudson killed when she was around, she'd throw suspicion off herself."
"Those murders weren't Suluk's style. If she wanted someone dead, no one would ever find the body. They'd just disappear. No body means no murder investigation, and no investigation means no contact with the police. That's her highest priority."
"Oh, yeah, I see that now."
"It's good you're being thorough."
"What's next?"
"Popcorn and apples and a movie. We'll get this video to Detective Ibarra in the morning and see if she's made any progress on her end. What movie shall we watch?"
"Is it okay if we watch Hellboy? I was telling Orla about Samael the Desolate One, Hound of Resurrection, and how the movie completely ignores physics, like the squirrel on the train did. So she wants to see it." Orla was immensely comforted to learn that creatures from hell regularly ignored physics, and that, therefore, squirrels must be from hell, which only confirmed our long-held suspicions. The world made sense again. In the morning, Granuel had already gone back to Poland, and Orla wanted to come with us, so we drove all the way to Portland, since we'd woken too late to catch the train. It was close enough to lunchtime when we got there that Detective Ibarra agreed to meet us in Beaverton at a Vietnamese place called Pho King Good, the name of which Atticus found amusing. The pho was indeed quite good. He bought bowls of brisket pho to go for us hounds and asked them to leave out the green onion. He and the detective sat on the curb and ate theirs next to us and did one of those squid pro go thingies. Radicus gave her the memory card from the camera and pretended he had gotten it from someone else.
"My guy found the woman from the security footage and got her to record a statement. Not sure how much it will help."
If it doesn't help enough, I'm gonna need your contact and talk to her in person.
Well, let's hope it helps enough then, because I doubt she can be found unless she wants to. The marmot stays off the grid as much as possible. It's amazing she let herself be filmed in the train station.
The marmot?
Shadowy figure. Sort of like Kaiser Soze, except she's involved in underground science instead of drugs.
You're messing with me, right?
No, it's true.
Damn. Just when I thought I'd heard everything. Well, you were right about someone being on the take. Remember that footage I showed you yesterday of this marmot person in the train station? He smuggled out a picture of her before I even had a look at it.
So that's how Su Luk had people tailing her so quickly, I said.
Yep, but they still had to identify her and track her down. That means some pretty serious resources. So you found him because he made a big cash deposit?
Yeah. Though he was trying to be smart about it by making smaller deposits, any cash deposit over a couple $100 for a cop is gonna raise some questions. Gave me a line about selling off a coin collection, but he had no proof of sale, and he didn't like the idea of being tied to the murder. He decided to help instead.
Are you gonna charge him?
Atticus said.
I haven't decided yet. He's dirty for sure, but you can't snitch on another cop without consequences.
How did he get the picture out?
Detective Ibarra held up the memory card Atticus gave her.
Like this, actually. He froze a frame of the footage, took a picture of it with a digital camera, removed the card, and made the handoff.
A live handoff?
Right in front of the station, too. Gigantic balls, eh?
So you have tape on that, I bet.
Yes, we do. But we can't really prove anything. The video's useless.
How so?
He was told to pick up a delivery of pizza and wings at a certain time. Delivery guy rides up on a scooter, and he's covered head to toe in winter gear, and the license plate is accidentally covered up as well. My dirty cop has the memory card folded up inside a couple of 20s for the driver, so you can't see him making any illegal exchange. And inside the bag of wings is actually a couple of fat stacks of bills for him.
But there was really pizza and wings in there, too?
Yeah.
So the pizza place is gonna have a record of that delivery. Gabby, we can nail the driver and...
Atticus didn't finish because the detective was shaking her head.
Already tried that. This place is called Pizza Pizza, and none of their locations have a record of a delivery to the station this week. Someone picked it up, paid cash, and then made the delivery. We're trying to figure out who that was now by going through the pizza place's tapes and matching orders for pizza and wings to faces. But it's just due diligence. Nothing will come of it. Even if we can match a nameless customer face to the order, it won't help because we can't match that face to the anonymous delivery guy. And before you ask, we also asked if any of their drivers use a scooter. No luck.
Damn.
Hey now, wait a second, Atticus. This isn't fitting together right.
What do you mean, Oberon?
He asked me mind to mind. This person in the winter clothes, they were at the train station, and they were also at the apartment complex, right? And then making this pizza delivery on a scooter.
Yeah, so?
So, remember you said there was a camera at the apartment complex pointed at the parking lot. What was the killer driving then? A scooter or something else?
Oh, good catch, Oberon. Let me ask.
He jerked his head around as if he'd just been struck by an idea and said,
Gabby, did you ever look at the footage from the parking lot?
Keene's place? Yeah. Perp was driving an older model white Corolla with stolen plates from Kansas.
So not a scooter, then?
No. That's a good point. We might be dealing with more than one person here.
Or the same person who's very careful to use a different vehicle for every crime, knowing how easy they are to trace.
We'll check the clothing and posture and so on to see if it's the same person or not.
Atticus, we should go to this pizza place and use our noses.
You just ate, Oberon.
I'm not talking about food this time. Maybe for the first time, I admit. But look, if it is the same person in all these tapes, and they've been to the pizza place, Starbuck might be able to pick up the scent, because he connected them in the stairwell and at the apartment.
That's worth a try,
he said to me privately, then turned to Gabby.
Which location would have delivered to the station? You have an address?
Yeah.
Why?
Atticus used his thumb to point at us.
Because the science of olfaction might still apply here. If the delivery dude was the same person who ransacked Keene's apartment, they might be able to pick up his scent. And the person who ransacked the apartment was the one who pulled the trigger at the train station.
The detective turned to consider us.
That's gonna be a paper-thin case. I don't know how I can prove they smelled the right guy. Or explain why we're stalking Pisa Pizza without exposing my crooked colleague.
I'm sure we'll figure something out if we have to. Let's just see what they can smell. Might be nothing.
Or it might be everything.
Won't know unless we try.
The humans finished up their fur and got everything thrown away before the detective looked up the address. She said she'd meet us there and drove separately. It took us 20 years to pull into the parking lot of a strip mall that featured a nail salon, a laundromat, and a tax preparation service in addition to Pizza Pizza. Altogether, it smelled of ethyl acetate, perfumed detergent, pepperoni, and existential despair. Radicus leased us up and asked privately that we let Starbuck lead on this, and also to ignore the stupid things he would say out loud to make it seem to the detective like we were trained scent hounds and not able to understand his speech. Heading up to the place, I wasn't sure that Starbuck or any hound could pick out a human smell over all the meat and cheese. And when the little guy said, "Yes, food," I thought the trip was a bust. But Atticus pressed the Boston to make sure.
Do you mean, yes, you smell food, or yes, you smell the man we're looking for?
Evidently, it was both. He might not have all his words yet, but he could still tell Atticus things through nonverbal cues and feelings.
Starbuck says the scent is strong, not just on the ground, but all around the door jamb.
Atticus looked at the detective.
He was here, no doubt about it.
He peered through the glass of the door to the interior, and I followed his gaze. There was a counter with a register and a menu hanging above it, showing delicious pies made of fat and grease. To the left of the counter, there was a gap leading into the kitchen area for employees.
I want to go in and check on something,
he said.
Back me up that these are service dogs.
Okay, sure.
But wait.
Atticus didn't wait. He pulled open the door and told Starbuck to follow that scent. No sooner did he cross the threshold than the manager called out a challenge. She was middle-aged, I think, had her hair pulled back into a ponytail hanging out the back of a baseball cap, and she looked and sounded tired.
Sir, you can't bring dogs in here. It's against the health code.
Starbuck ignored her and pulled to the left, short snout tracking along the floor, his nose full of bad guy. He headed straight for that gap in the counter rather than the cash register where customers would go. The manager got louder the closer we got to the kitchen and moved to intercept us. Atticus told us to hold up before we started an imbroglio. That's a word that you can pull out most anywhere and expect someone to give you brownie points, or sometimes an actual brownie. He turned to Detective Ibarra and said,
"He works here. We'll wait outside."
We headed back for the door as the detective flashed her badge at the manager.
Portland Homicide, we have reason to believe one of your employees is involved in a murder.
You've got to be shitting me,
the manager said.
This is all I need.
I didn't hear the detective's answer to that because the door closed behind us after that, and Atticus congratulated us on being awesome.
Only a matter of time now,
he said. We are about to solve another crime, and it's all thanks to the best hounds anywhere. Negotiations for a special meal are now open.
Chicken fried steak with gravy,
Orla suggested.
Shredded beef brisket poutine,
I said, because I figured we would win either way.
Yes, food,
Starbuck added. He's not picky yet. The detective brought out a series of sullen teenagers, one by one, to see if any of them matched the scent of the killer. Starbuck snuffled at each greasy hand, but none of them matched. The detective was bringing the manager to the door just as a car drove up with a Pizza Pizza sign attached to the top of it by a magnet. Atticus was paying attention to the detective and the manager coming to the door, so he didn't see the car or the guy who got out of it. He was pretty tall and ripped for a delivery guy. He looked like he could be a bouncer or a bodyguard and make lots more money that way, just flexing at smaller people and intimidating them. He was a white guy who had his hair cut the way white supremacists do, short on the sides and a small lawn of dark, limp hair on the top. I barked almost by reflex, because ever since World War II, Vaticus has lived by the moral code that
if you see a Nazi, punch a Nazi.
And this guy set off my alarm bells. That car of his was white, too.
Whoa, Vaticus, have Starbuck check out this dude.
Vaticus didn't even have to ask because Starbuck sensed him coming and turned to investigate. His wee nose snuffled and twitched in the air as the detective pushed open the door and the guy said,
"Excuse me."
Since we were kind of blocking the entrance, Vaticus automatically started to move out of the way, and the detective held the door open as Starbuck planted himself and started barking like five cats had stolen all his fish sticks.
"No, squirrel!"
he shouted, but Atticus got more sense out of him than that.
"It's him,"
he told the detective, and things happened pretty fast after that.
"Detective Ibarra,"
she said and pulled out her badge.
"Portland,
Lightning fast, the dude shocked her in the nose before she could finish and straight-kicked Atticus in the gut, knocking him down and thereby jerking our leashes in the process. Then he took off, but not to his car, which surprised me. He was headed for the other end of the strip mall, where I guess he hoped to turn the corner. There must be an alley back there or someplace he thought he could hide.
"Bring him down,"
Atticus sat in our heads and let go of our leashes.
"But don't break the skin."
The dude was pretty fast for a human, but he was slower than a box turtle on barbiturates compared to three hounds. We caught up to him in front of the nail salon. Starbuck and I nipped at his heels and tripped him up. He fell sprawling on the concrete, and Orla just kept running right over him, making sure to plant a foot on the back of his head and ram his chin into the sidewalk. But once she was off him and passed, he kicked out at me and Starbuck, tagging both of us. Though it didn't hurt much, it just pushed us back and gave him room to gain his feet. Vaticus wasn't having any of that. The guy would probably be able to aim a much better kick from a standing position. I heard Atticus mumble something in Old Irish. He was making a binding of some kind, and Detective Ibarra was telling him to freeze.
"You can back away. I've got him now,"
Atticus said, and I saw what he meant. The guy took exactly one step, and then the inseams of his jeans fused together as he tried to take another, and he fell down again, growling in his frustration. He flopped like a professional soccer player, but then Detective Ibarra fell on him with a knee in his back, pinning him. She had him in cuffs a few seconds later, and Atticus undid the binding on his jeans.
"Good job, you three,"
Atticus told us in our heads.
Where did he think he was going?
I trotted to the corner and looked past the mall. There was one of those alleys where trucks could make deliveries, but then there was a low wall he could have jumped over, and he'd be in an apartment complex. Lots of places to hide in there and lose us. He might have made it if he could have gotten over the wall back there, I said. No way he could have lost us in the car once the detective made him. It was probably his best move. But it just wasn't good enough against the hounds of the Willamette and their pet druid.
Pet druid? Really?
Don't complain now. You know we take good care of you. The detective smooshed the perp's face into the concrete with one hand because he was calling her some rather unkind names and used her other hand to fish a wallet out of his back pocket. She flipped it open and read the name on the driver's license. She sniffed before talking because she had a bloody nose.
Brock Slater, you're under arrest for assaulting a police officer, she said. And we'll see what we can add on to that later.
The manager of Pizza Pizza came over and put her hands on her hips.
Now I've got to do all the deliveries tonight. You're fired, Brock. You asshole.
I didn't think that was enough. You can't kick me, Starbuck, and Atticus, and punch our taco friend Gabby, and just get handcuffed and fired. I remembered Atticus's rule about Nazis, and realized he couldn't follow through on that now. Gabby wouldn't allow stuff like that. But I could modify Atticus's rule and get away with it. I trotted over to him and lifted my leg on his head. I have pretty good aim. Gabby reared back just in time so none of it got on her.
Oberon, what are you doing?
Atticus sounded horrified. If you see a Nazi, pee on a Nazi, I said. I'm modifying your rule to match my particular skill set. Brock Slater made grunting noises and swore a lot and demanded Gabby do something because I had a half liter or gallon or whatever to unload on him, and it was taking a while.
I love the help, but I'm fully occupied just keeping you restrained. I'll tell him he's a bad dog, though.
She grinned at me, which Slater couldn't see.
Bad dog, Oberon.
She is totally gonna buy me some tacos later. I can tell.
Chapter 9. Gone Squirrel.
I thought for the longest time that chicken fried steak was steak that had been fried by specially trained chickens, and as such was one of the rarest delicacies on the planet. You can imagine my epic disappointment when I learned that chickens weren't involved in the preparation at all, not even as part of the ingredients. Humans just fried up steak the same way they fried chicken, using a batter with secret herbs and spices. I felt sure that one of the secret herbs had to be ground up chicken bits, because why else would they be advertising that it's chicken fried? But no, Atticus said, it was just another example of the English language being stupid sometimes. And chicken bits wouldn't count as an herb in any case. When I asked him about the bottles of spices called poultry seasoning he had in his pantry, he explained that it was seasoning for poultry, not seasoning made of poultry. That was a sad day of shattered illusions and disappointment with language, let me tell you. And Orla suffered almost the same heartbreak
when she got her reward for fighting crime, because she thought chicken fried steak meant the steak would be fried inside a chicken. Gravy on top made it better, of course, but I also tried to soothe her with a weird English thing that was a pleasant surprise. You know humans sometimes eat this stuff they call surf and turf?
That doesn't sound very good,
she said. I know, but it's a trick, because they don't actually eat either one. It's a code phrase for steak and lobster. They say it's because cows live on turf and lobsters swim in the surf, but who are they kidding? They just like to rhyme. We were feeling pretty smug, and Atticus said that was okay because we'd earned it.
Brock Slater had thought of everything but hounds. We never would have found him if it weren't for your noses. And that squirrel on the train.
What? We have to share credit with a squirrel? I said, and Orla protested too.
That's not right. The squirrel didn't help at all.
And for once, when Starbuck said, "No, squirrel," it made perfect sense in context. Atticus just laughed at us.
I only meant we wouldn't have run into that stairwell and gotten involved if it weren't for that squirrel. I'm not saying the squirrel did anything helpful. I know you did all the work.
We calmed down after that, and I admitted that the detective had done quite a bit as well, especially after handcuffing Slater. Once she got a warrant to search his home, they found a 3D printer, two plastic crossbows, and plenty of bolts. There was also a bag of cash and a dossier on Hudson Keene in his kitchen, plus clothing that matched the outfit the killer wore. His car make and model matched the surveillance video of Keene's apartment complex, even if the license plate did not. Atticus said it was a circumstantial case, but about as strong a one as you could hope for. Strong enough that Brock Slater was willing to confess and give what information he could about who paid him for some kind of leniency on his sentence. He wasn't a professional ex-military hitman who'd die before he talked. He was
more of a punk-ass nihilist,
Atticus said, who thought he'd never get caught as long as he kept his face off the cameras. And he had no code of honor or sense of loyalty to whoever hired him. I am not sure how punk asses differ from regular asses, and I don't have a clue what a nihilist is either. I confess I didn't ask Atticus to explain, because sometimes his explanations are short, and sometimes they are college lectures. Maybe a nihilist is someone who thinks the end is nigh. So it's okay to kill people for money. And it's okay to rat out your buddies afterward, too. Slater gave up the names of the two guys who killed Ignacio Medina in Eugene and who also came after Sir Luke Black. I guess they were nihilists, too. Detective Ibarra reported that Slater said,
"They were supposed to find the woman who saw me do Keene, but I haven't heard back."
He never would. And we couldn't help the police find those two guys without getting in trouble ourselves. The confession made the detective very happy, because she didn't need to worry about things like who the marmot was or reveal that there was a crooked cop involved in the investigation. She was going to make him donate all the money to charity and tell him to keep his nose clean, which only reinforced my belief that clean noses are truly an obsession with humans. And since we'd helped her clean another murder off her books, Detective Ibarra was quite happy with us in general, and decided maybe that Atticus was a guy she could trust to do the right thing. She told Atticus next time the tacos were on her, and I knew we were solid then. I was so excited about future tacos, I almost missed out on some of the unfinished business.
Slater didn't have the name of his client, but he shared every detail of how contact was made and how the money was delivered. He also gave up information on a whole bunch of other stuff he'd done since his position as a pizza delivery guy allowed him to go anywhere without suspicion. He did the occasional drug run, or money drop for shady guys while delivering pies. The detective would follow up on that because it wasn't something we could really help with, and Atticus said we'd done enough by solving the murders. He and Suluk could start Stable Solar and Battery now, and he was so pleased with us that he was going to take us to Portland again to smell all the things, since we never got to do it properly the first time. He also promised to take us to a place that had oxtail poutine on the menu, and we were ready to get on board for that. Except for the fact that the squirrel got away at the start. I thought the proverbial biscuits had landed once again on the side of justice and gravy. And I knew that one day that squirrel would get his justice, too.
Epilogue.
A couple of days later, we arrived in the Eugene train station to begin our Portland-smelling expedition. And there was a squirrel on top of the train again! It might have even been the same squirrel as before. What if he was a commuter? Okay, Atticus, you have to admit this time that something weird is going on. This is not normal behavior. No squirrel, Starbuck said.
All right, I'll admit that it's unusual. If you want to find out what's happening, I'll help this time. But you have to behave strangely, too, if this is going to work.
How do you mean?
If we get to Portland and he hasn't been destroyed by physics, we'll follow him. But you can't bark at him and tip him off that he's being tailed. We have to be sneaky about it. Think you can do that?
You want us not to bark at a squirrel?
Orla said.
That's beyond strange. That's unnatural.
I agreed with Orla and said so. We might be crossing a line here, Atticus.
It's the squirrel who's crossed the line,
he argued.
And if you want to get to the bottom of this, you're going to have to cross a line too. I'll tap into his noggin and keep tabs on him, so even if he ducks around a corner, we won't lose him, okay?
Orla and I weren't too sure about the plan, but decided to try it in the end. Barking sure felt good. It felt right. But it hadn't worked up to that point, so maybe it was time to try a new strategy.
You'll be stealth hounds,
Atticus said, and that made us feel a little better about not barking. It was stealth technology. We got onto the train camouflaged as before, and were quiet like before, and Atticus didn't have any trouble with the train staff. But once we got to Portland and stepped out on the platform, we looked up at the roof of the train and saw that squirrel, smug as a frat boy who got a deal on a keg of cheap beer. You see him, Atticus? Oh, I see him, and I'm not barking.
Me neither, but it's really hard.
Orla said. Starbuck made a low growl in his throat, but didn't bark. We reminded him we were going stealth, and he stopped.
I see him, and I'm binding to him now,
Atticus said.
Even if he dips out of sight, I won't lose him. Let's just follow at a safe distance.
The little poofy rat scrambled along the top of the train and jumped to the roof of the platform canopy before shimmying down the post, just like he had before. But he took a different route after that, leading us out of the station, slipping out a door behind someone who was unconscious of him being there.
Huh. I'm starting to think something's up,
Atticus said. Only now you're starting to think that? Well, better late than never, I guess.
This isn't a random search for food. The squirrel has a destination in mind. He's moving with purpose.
Orla said, "We've been trying to explain to you and Granuaile that they always have a sinister purpose, but you never believe us."
Well, a purpose and a sinister purpose are very different things. Let's wait and see.
"Can't you find out what the purpose is?" I asked.
Not without alerting him that I'm around. He'll know something weird is going on in his head. All I'm picking up from his surface emotions is an eagerness to get where he's going.
"We tried so hard to keep our chill. The squirrel used a combination of trees and rooftops to travel above the street wherever he could. Wait! Atticus, is this squirrel a dude?"
"Yes."
"What's his name?"
Squirrels don't have names that translate well into English. I mean, you're not going to find a Bob or a Jacob or a Zachariah. They use a gender pronoun followed by an accomplishment or an embarrassment, and sometimes they change. Right now, this one is called He Who Knows How to Travel on Loud Shiny Human Tube Things. Trains, in other words.
"That's actually encouraging. It means not all the squirrels have figured it out yet. We kept after him and gradually realized that we were in familiar territory. He was leading us to Washington Park."
"Hey, are we headed back to the Japanese Gardens?"
Orla asked.
"We're headed in that general direction, but Washington Park is pretty big."
"It's a trap!"
I said in my best impression of Admiral Akbar.
"It's probably completely innocent, Oberon. There's an arboretum in there, remember? That means it'll have some nuts and seeds a squirrel can't find anywhere else in Oregon. He's probably interested in gourmet nuts and is willing to travel for them."
"I don't know, Atticus. I've never heard of any nuts worth this much trouble. But we'll wait and see, as you said." It turned out not to be, as Atticus insisted, completely innocent. It wasn't even a little bit innocent. The squirrel didn't lead us to the Japanese gardens or the arboretum, but rather to what I can only call a dread assemblage. I can count to 20 just fine, and there were more than 20 trees in a wooded area of the park that had more than 20 squirrels each in them. He who knows how to travel on loud, shiny human tube things scrambled up one of the trees, and Atticus said this was where he wanted to go, so we could go ahead and bark all we wanted. The thing is, we were too stunned to let rip more than a confused woof or two. We never seen so many squirrels in one place before and didn't know what to do. Oh, they were chattering away, but not fighting over anything. They were obviously there to cooperate on something, a conspiracy right under our noses. Or above our noses, since they were all sticking to the branches out of our reach. That's when I counted them. Marcus, what's 20 times 20?
400.
No, that's more than a million, right?
No, it's far less.
Well, it doesn't matter. The number of squirrels we have here is clearly unsafe.
I don't feel particularly endangered.
Starbuck must have felt encouraged by that somehow because he started barking in earnest, leaping up to scare the squirrels if he could. They chattered back at him, probably making fun, but didn't move around or seem very worried. Orla said,
"You'd admit this is weird, though, right?"
"Oh, sure. I've never seen this before. It's pretty cool."
I spluttered. "Cool? How can you say that, Atticus?"
"I like it whenever I see something new. Guy always finds a way to surprise me somehow, and I think it's wonderful."
"No, no, no. None of that. Find out why they're here, and then we'll see how wonderful it is. Go on. Ask that one who was on the train."
"Okay, I will."
There was a pause, and Atticus had this tiny little grin on his face like everything was so amusing, and there was nothing to worry about. but I kept watching his face, and when the grin fell away and turned into a frown, I asked him what he found out.
Well, it's pretty disturbing.
I can handle the truth!
They're here to discuss how to deal with you. Well, not you specifically, but dogs in general. They think you're annoying.
Ha! That takes a lot of nerve, calling us annoying.
Orla said, yeah!
It gets worse. They think the best way to get rid of dogs is to get rid of humans, which they think will be easier for some reason.
Oh, well, they can dream on. If bears couldn't do that, what chance did they have?
That's what they're here to talk about. But, Starbuck is kind of making their point right now. Starbuck?
My little Boston buddy was still barking at the Dread Assemblage, and they'd all stopped chattering, except for one. He was in the tree above Starbuck, and he pointed one of his little paws straight at Atticus. As 400 squirrels all turned to look at my druid, and I knew what they were thinking. Get rid of one human, and you get rid of all his dogs.
Starbuck, stop. I think we should go. Really. Oberon, Orla, let's go get that poutine.
Atticus started backing away, and I was just about to argue with him when that one squirrel screeched, and then all the squirrels started scampering down their trees. It's a mighty creepy thing, hearing all those claws scrabbling on tree bark, seeing all those fluffy tails twitching, all those dead black eyes coming right at you. Ah! It really is a trap! We can't repel squirrel power of that magnitude!
Let's take a strategic lunch break right now, Atticus said. Fast! Come on, run!
I had to run through the streets of Cairo once with Atticus, while all the cats of that city chased us right into the Nile River. And I remember feeling humiliated by it, hoping nobody was filming it to put on YouTube later. This was worse. But different, too. Once we got to the boundary of the park, the squirrels stopped chasing us. And it was also different because Atticus was laughing about it, clutching his stomach because he could hardly breathe. "What are you doing? That wasn't funny!" I said.
"Are you kidding?" That was the most fun I've had in ages. Woo! What a trip! Running for my life from 400 squirrels! Know how many times I've done that in 2,000 years? Just this once. Oh, that's a rare day for you.
Atticus, we've just uncovered a vast conspiracy, and you're ignoring it.
I understand, Oberon. I get it now. Squirrels are dangerous.
Finally,
Orla said, you say that, but you're still smiling.
I'm gonna be smiling for days, and you'll just have to deal with my joy. But I also know we must be vigilant, and we will. But the squirrels are just talking. They won't start anything today. It's safe to go get lunch and enjoy the rest of the city. Who's hungry?
I didn't trust the expression on Atticus's face. He was trying to change the subject to food, and I've been with him long enough now to know that when he does that, he's trying to hide something. He probably didn't share everything he found out from the super tiny mind of he who knows how to travel on loud, shiny human tube things. Orla and Starbuck weren't used to such shenanigans, though.
Yes, food, the Boston said.
I'm ready, Orla agreed. If we're going to defend all humanity from the coming squirrel menace, we should have some gravy first.
Well, I couldn't argue with her reasoning there.
She's a super smart hound. And I'm a super lucky one. This has been Oberon's Meaty Mysteries, The Squirrel on the Train. Written by Kevin Hearn. Narrated by Luke Daniels. Copyright 2017 by Kevin Hearn. Production copyright 2017 by Kevin Hearn.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.